So Bob has volunteered to give us, a layman's survey of the progress over the last 2 years and the status of one of the biggest and most productive areas of experimental particle physics.
Okay. Actually, this is probably an introduction to the next talk, because really lattice gauge theory is a warm-up problem for the much more difficult problem of performing simulations of strongly correlated electron systems and studying high TC. But there is some interest in studying lattice gauge theory in its own right. I won't embarrass David by reminding you of how many years ago it was that he and his friends invented quantum chromodynamics. But it is embarrassing for the rest of us that in all of the time since he and his friends did that, we still haven't arrived at a really good way of performing calculations of those aspects of the theory which involve its long-distance behavior. Therefore, those aspects where the coupling is strong and you can't use perturbation theory. Lattice gauge theory is holds the prospect of enabling us to do just that, of making calculations of QCD in the non-perturbative regime from first principles and with full control over the errors. Problem, as I will show you today, is that in most cases, yeah, I too popular. Okay, shall we wait? I'll erase the blackboard. I David said that this, you know, blackboard lunches are supposed to be light club. This is supposed to be for the non-experts, so I'm going to write down one equation for in this talk, and that's and that's the action for QCD, because once you know the action, of course, you know everything, and you can. Okay. So there's a field strength tensor with a color index. And then there are terms involving the interactions of the quarks with the gauge fields. So that's the theory we want to solve, right? The FBU nu is a field strength tensor, except it's for a non-abelian gauge theory, unlike electrodynamics. The D slash is the covariant derivative, which involves the gluon fields. The psi bar and psi are the quark fields, and M cubed, the quark masses. So the homework assignment is to solve that theory. Huh? I'll get to that in just a second. Yeah, it's going to be Euclidean. Okay, so there's the theory, and oops, we need to back up, that we're supposed to solve. To tell you the punchline at the beginning, there are a few quantities which we can really calculate well, down to an accuracy that they have some real impact with on experiment or are of experimental at the experimental level. There are a whole host of quantities which would be very important to calculate, where we can do a good enough job, so we think we can say with some confidence what additional computing power or improvement in algorithms is needed to really do a good job. And there's a lot of excitement in the field because people are very close to that. And I'm going to come back at the end and try to tell you that. But I'm going to illustrate where we stand by looking at three problems. One has to do with the spectrum, the masses of hadrons, right? The fundamental entities in this action are quarks and gluons. What we see in nature are protons and neutrons and rho mesons and pi mesons and things like that. We should be able to calculate those masses. I want to say a little few words about what we know about high temperature QCD. That's an important problem because at high temperatures we do expect to see a plasma of quarks and gluons, and new relativistic heavy ion collider at Brookhaven, which is just gearing up, has as one of its chief purposes to look at that, to search for the quark gluon plasma. And finally, I think that from the point of view of a particle physicist like me, the most interesting things that we can calculate in the next few years have to do with the weak decays of strongly interacting particles, that those have a direct bearing on our understanding of the standard model. So I want to say a little bit about each of those. Before I do, because the assumption is that almost everybody is a non-expert, I want to say a little bit about how the calculations go, and so tell you what are the sources of the errors or uncertainties that we have to fight against, and what you should look out for when a lattice gauge theorist tries to sell you a hot new result. What happens in lattice gauge theory is that one simply is attempting by brute force to evaluate the Feynman path integrals of the theory. And the starting point for doing that is just a simple relation from finite temperature statistical mechanics. If we want the expectation value for some operator O, we should look at the trace of e to the minus beta h over trace e to the minus beta h, for which we can write path integrals. And as Jim pointed out, we'll write path integrals in Euclidean time. So there's some integral over gauge fields and over quark fields of e to the minus the Euclidean action times O, which is a function of A and psi over is all we're going to do. Now, the reason we're not going to use real-time formalism is that, as you know, the path integrals would have, would have factors of I here, and the integrals would oscillate like mad. There would be no hope of evaluating them numerically. Okay, this means that there are a limited number of quantities we can actually calculate by this method. We can calculate static quantities like masses and properties of phase transitions or weak decay constants. We can't calculate scattering amplitudes, and we're very far from being able to do that. Now, in most cases,
what was the status of maximum entropy method?
In the calculations we're trying to do, there is very little hope of doing that because these are really huge systems. I mean, with millions of degrees of freedom when the smoke clears. So and those methods, I mean, there are methods which people have of doing stochastic calculations in real time, and they typically run out of steam with only a very small number of degrees of freedom. Here we're going to be talking about millions or tens of millions of degrees of freedom, and there's no, we don't know how to do that. It would be wonderful if we did, but we don't. Okay. Now, except for looking at high temperature QCD, we typically want to look at zero temperature, and that says beta, which is 1 over KT, goes to infinity, or gets very large at least. And then the only term in this trace that counts is the ground state, and we'll just get the ground state expectation value like that. Okay, if I just put in a complete set of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, as long as T is much less than the typical energy scales of the system, then only the ground state will contribute. So one of the things you have to worry about is whether you've really taken beta large enough so that you're not contaminated by excited states when you think you're calculating ground state wave function, when you think you're calculating ground state expectation values. So maybe I should list sources of the first thing you have to do when you want to do calculations is put the theory on a lattice. And you need a lattice for several reasons. One is simply to regularize the theory. The continuum theory has both ultraviolet and infrared singularities if you proceed in a naive way. The lattice provides you with the means of regularizing the theory in a way that doesn't spoil the gauge invariance of the theory, and that's something that Ken Wilson taught us how to do a long time ago. So I have a four-dimensional Euclidean lattice, and associated with each of the lattice points are the quarks, and the gauge fields are associated with the links on the lattice, and they can parallel transport the gauge fields from one lattice point to another. But in the end, when you want to actually make contact with the theory you started from, you have to let the lattice spacing go to zero. You have to perform calculations at a lot of different lattice spacings and then hopefully continue them to zero lattice spacing. And so you really have to worry about errors associated with finite lattice spacing. And that's one of the big problems, which I'll try to show you something about. In order to have a finite number of degrees of freedom, even once you're on a lattice, you also have to introduce a spatial box, periodic boundary conditions. And of course, our box is a finite size, namely beta, in the time direction. In introducing a finite box, you've got to be careful that the box is big enough so that it doesn't squeeze the states whose properties you're trying to calculate. Some very distinguished physicists have done lattice gauge theory calculations on in boxes which are much smaller than the particles they were studying. And what was really as embarrassing is that they sometimes got the answer they wanted to get, which is very bad for the field. Okay, so there are finite size effects that you have to watch out for. Okay. And the combination of these two things, of course, can cause you some real difficulty, because if you fix the spatial size of your lattice and you fix beta and you want to go to smaller lattice spacing to approach the continuum limit, you have to add more and more lattice points, and if you fail to do that, you get in trouble at the other end. Okay? Now, there's another problem here, which is that the up and down quarks have masses that are on the order of 4 or 5 MeV, which is much smaller than any of the energy scales in the problem. And when the dust clears, what you're really doing with all this supercomputer time that the field is building up is over and over again calculating the propagators of quarks through some background gauge field in the course of the simulation. Now, that means inverting the Dirac operator, D/-M, the lattice version of that, which is now a matrix which typically has dimension millions or tens of millions even. And that matrix is becoming increasingly ill-conditioned as the quark mass gets smaller. So all lattice gauge theory calculations up to now have been done with quark masses which are, with up and down quark masses, which are larger than the physical values, and one needs to do an extrapolation to the chiral limit to physical up and down quark masses. Okay. Excuse me?
Is this equal to the minus sine?
No. There is no. In everything I'm going to talk about today, there is no sine problem because we're always working at half filling. Okay. There is a very important class of problems having to do with hadronic matter at non-zero chemical potential, which one would dearly love to solve. And this, doing those problems, has the same difficulties as strongly correlated electron systems at non-zero chemical potential, finite doping, for exactly the same reason, that the quark determinant can then change sign and you're in the soup. Okay. So the good news for lattice gauge theorists is that most of the problems they want to do are really at half filling, namely all the negative energy states in the Dirac C of the quarks are filled. The bad news is we have no better idea than the condensed matter people how to work at finite chemical potential, and we really like to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just that the operator D/ has zero eigenvalues, okay, and then MQ goes to zero. And they're real Goldstone bosons. Okay.
No question?
Yeah?
Is there actually extract experimentally the quark masses?
Oh, okay.
Is there any ambiguity in doing
that? For the... For the lattice people, there's no ambiguity. It's a parameter in the theory. The ambiguity is you have to relate that. It's a parameter. You then define, in the continuum theory, you have to define the quark mass in terms of some real amplitude that you can calculate and that makes physical sense. And you can relate the bare quark masses in the theory back to that. Now, you know from chiral perturbation theory how the hadronic masses should depend on the quark masses at small quark masses. And, of course, you can calculate that on the lattice. And, therefore, you can you can define in that way things you call physical quark masses, which are just parameters, or at least ratios of them. Okay. Good. So, okay. these things, fine. Now, in what you want to do to perform the simulation, you know, these are stochastic simulations, and you'd like to generate a set of field configurations whose probability is proportional to e to the minus s, or indeed simply to this quantity. Now, in path integrals, the fermions are represented by anti-commuting C numbers, which means that you have to integrate out the quark fields before you start, because the computer chokes on those. And what that does is it gives you a determinant of this operator, and that's highly non-local in the remaining gauge fields. The non-locality of the quark determinant means that the algorithms for generating these configurations of gauge fields in which you're going to measure physical operators becomes much more difficult. For fixed lattice volume, if the determinant weren't there, the computing time goes is about a to the minus fourth, where a is the lattice spacing, okay, which is getting small. With them there, it goes approximately as a to the minus sixth. And it really is what makes these calculations exceedingly difficult. Now, for some processes, one believes that it's really the glue that the gluon self interactions that are the major do the major share of the work. An example is the light hadron masses, and that the C quarks, the quark anti quark pairs, which are described by this determinant, are less important. On the other hand, there are cases such as high temperature QCD where if you neglect the C quarks, you just get completely the wrong physics, period. So you don't want to throw away the fermion determinant. Nevertheless, a lot of the calculations that have been done in lattice gauge theory have done exactly that, and that's called the quenched approximation. It's a bad thing to do, but sometimes it's the only thing.
Is the matrix determinant you want to evaluate emission or
symmetric? No, this term is anti-hermitian, and this term is hermitian. And in fact, that's why the determinant, as long as there isn't a chemical potential, is always positive, because it has eigenvalues which are plus I times something and minus I times something, and therefore you have something positive definite as long as you're working at half filling. Okay, so you see a lot of work done in the quenched approximation. And what you really want to see is work done in full QCD without neglecting the the fermion determinant, or at the very minimum, enough here so you can estimate what the errors are due to quenching. Okay, so those are really the main sources of errors. Again, with enough computing time, you can really keep control of all these errors. These are the systematic errors. Then there are of course statistical errors, and those, as I'll indeed even show you, are possible to beat down. That's not the problem. The real problem lies over here, right? In making these extrapolations up and down. Physical up and down quark masses, or better yet, to really calculate at the at their physical values, to have control over finite lattice spacing and finite size effects, to do the extrapolation to zero lattice spacing without violating this, and to really do the calculations to full QCD. Well, there are, I was going to finesse that because this wasn't for experts, but let me just say that there's more than one way of putting quarks on the lattice, and none of them are entirely satisfactory. In the limit of zero lattice spacing, you believe that they will all give the same and correct answer. However, at finite lattice spacing, some methods violate chiral symmetry. Some become non-local. Some have extra particles in them. And those extra particles, again, become very, very heavy and are supposed to decouple at small lattice spacing. There's a lot of work going into improving how you put the quarks on the lattice. And there's been some, and I'm not going to talk about it, but there's been some real theoretical advances in putting chiral left-handed particles on the lattice, and which somehow which addresses some of these, but those actions end up being pretty non-local, and as an engineering problem, look hard to simulate. But that's a story which is just starting. Okay. Well, I want to show you how some of this goes. How are we doing? Not well. Yeah, and I could put, as you said, an extra problem down here that there are different ways of putting the quarks on the lattice. One really wants to understand that they get the same answers and presumably correct answers. And I'll show you one slide about that. Let me start out looking at the spectrum, and just to, and what we're going to do is this. This is beta, and let's have this be one of our spatial dimensions, and you imagine the other two coming out of the board. And what I'm supposed to do is put down some source over here, which will create from the vacuum a particle with the quantum numbers that I would like. And I can arrange that source so it creates something at zero momentum. Then I put another sink over here, and maybe those are a distance t apart. And the correlation function from this source and sink here should go like e to the minus the energy difference between the vacuum and the state, which is the mass of the particle, because we're at zero momentum, and t. Actually, there's another term, which is e to the minus, if this is a meson, beta minus t, and if it were a fermion, there'd be a minus sign there. But we ought to, now, there will be excited states too, but if we look at t large and beta large, we ought to be able to see, and we have to be very careful that we look, that the excited states fall off, and we can calculate the lowest state with those quantum numbers. Now, if we're really good, we'll keep the excited state, and we'll get the first excited state with those quantum numbers, too. And that's harder. So let me pull this down and show you how some of those things look. Here's, whoops, a picture of the pion. Let's see. Of the pion propagator on a 24 by 6 cube by 64 lattice with full QCD and a relatively light quark mass. And these are about the largest lattices that have been studied with full QCD, but not.
This is state of the art.
This is state of the art. Okay. And what I want you to notice is this is a log plot, and you can see that this is falling off exponentially. And right here in the middle, that's because this is a cosh instead of an exponential. And I think you can easily imagine that I could figure out what the mass is. Here I wouldn't take the few lightest states, few smallest separations, but that looks pretty good. You should understand we're calculating the propagator every separation in this propagator in the same set of couple hundred gauge configurations, and so those points are all correlated, and in calculating errors, we got to take that into account. And we actually, no, the boxes are plotting symbols. They're little, if you could see these little points inside, those are sort of the error bars. The pion is the easiest thing. The pion is the easiest thing to calculate.
But it's not the real pion, right? It's not the real pion here. Because
it's
as long as it's still not 5 MeV.
Oh, no, 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 it's
so,
not.
So in this way, it's kind of a parallel pi.
Well, yeah, well, this is in lattice units. That's the lattice spacing. 0.01 is the lattice spacing times the quark mass. And then we have to figure out what the lattice spacing is. Okay. Anything you calculate on the lattice is going to be in units of the lattice spacing, and then you have to give yourself some, you've got to give yourself some, one of the masses, or some physical dimensionful quantity to fix the lattice spacing.
Yeah.
That's a coupling. G is the gauge coupling complex. There are many reasons why the pion is easiest. One is that there's a big separation to the excited state. Another one is that it's light, which means that the signal, although it's fallen off here by about five orders of magnitude, hasn't fallen off that much so that you aren't losing the signal. And the third reason is you're always adding up for the pion positive definite quantities. The fluctuations are minimized. Now, I don't want you to think that life is always that good to you. So here on the same lattice is the rho meson propagator. And you see that eventually you just run out of steam here. And you see up top here, it's not linear, and that's because there are excited states that aren't so far removed. But nevertheless, I think you can think that there is a region in here before you lose control where you could really extract the mass of the rho. Okay. And here's the nucleon just to show you that things sort of the same. And then there are other higher mass particles and such where things are much more rugged. Okay. Now, I said you ought to look at finite size effects, and here is a figure from a study of finite size effects, all at the same all at the same lattice spacing, different quark masses, and different sizes box. And the idea is like to understand how big the box is in some physical units before that we can with confidence extract the mass, that we're not squeezing our states and such. You have to keep doing this because, as was pointed out, any calculation you do on the lattice is not at the physical masses of these particles. And so, for example, the pion cloud isn't its physical size, so I can't just go and read off from the particle data book how big my box has to be in physical units. But I have to keep understanding that, and different physical quantities that you might like to calculate have different finite size effects, and indeed different finite lattice spacing effects. But when the you've done all that, here's an example from that study with full QCD on pretty large lattices of, in this case, it's the rho mass, again, in units of the lattice spacing versus the quark mass in units of the lattice spacing. So it doesn't mean anything yet until I tell you what the lattice spacing is. But calculated at a range of quark masses and at different lattice spacing, so I'm getting ready to do all those extrapolations that I told you about. Again, the particle mass as a function of the quark mass is pretty smooth, and that's true here in full QCD and in the quenched approximation. You would think you could make a nice fit to this, although it's clearly not a linear fit that you're going to have to have to make. Okay. Now, the problem is that this, it's very easy to do interpolations and much harder to do extrapolations. So here's the nucleon mass, and this is actually in the quenched approximation from a 32 cube by, I think, 84 lattice. No. Yes, that's right. And we're trying to make different fits, which are taken from expectations of chiral perturbation theory. And as you can see, that in the region where you've actually, of quark masses, that you've actually done the measurement, you can do pretty well, and all the fits agree except for this one oddball one, which one can understand. But they all, of course, separate down here, and this is where you actually want to know. And this is, in fact, the largest source of error in our present ability to estimate the nucleon mass, is that doing these chiral extrapolations is a tough game.
How much would the quenched approximation change, or
this,
use the quenched approximation if you didn't?
I'm going to show you that in a minute. I'll show you that in a minute. This one I just showed you is from the quenched approximation. I didn't grab it. Now, here, the next step in this is you assume you've been able to do the extrapolation to as a function of the quark masses. You then keep some physical quantity fixed, which typically is taken to be the ratio of the pi to the rho mass, because that really fixes the quark mass in physical units. And then you should be able to extrapolate to zero lattice spacing. And here we're trying to do that for the in the quenched approximation for the ratio of the nucleon to the rho masses. This is a quantity which has been a source of real embarrassment to lattice gauge theorists up until the last few years, because typically it always came out to be about 1.4 or 1.5, and the real answer is 1.24 down here. And the reason is that we never before had enough really good data to do all these extrapolations carefully. Okay. This ratio should go for the action that's being used here, which is the staggered or Kogut-Suskind action, should go like the lattice spacing squared, and so A m rho squared is proportional to the lattice spacing squared, and if you take all but the last point up there, you get a very nice fit to zero lattice spacing, which is maybe one standard deviation away from the physical answer. Not so surprising that it isn't exactly right, because you've left out all of the z-course. And if you want to fit this by putting in a higher order term, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, because everything's controlled by the last few points. Okay? So then Matthew says, well, now how much difference does it make if you do the quenched or full QCD, or can you ever see any difference? In fact, as people always used to worry, they couldn't. For full QCD, we haven't worked at light enough quark masses so that one can feel very confident extrapolating to the physical value of m pi over m rho. But if we are in a region where we're doing interpolations, which is shown here, and I'm showing you, again, the quenched results, and these are the full QCD results. It is pretty well, unfortunately, I changed the axis here. This is m rho instead of m rho squared. So this should be quadratic, and that's very nicely fit by that. But there is a real difference. And at this point, we have control over the errors, which we wouldn't have at the physical value of m pi over m rho. It does. And in fact, let me now show you a more alarming picture. You don't want those quarks. Right. Here's, there is no question that the m pi over m rho is larger for a ways. Now, and you can say, well, what in the world is going on here? And it's, there's a good question, even if you don't believe these last few points, which you probably don't, there's consistency. All of the dynamical quark work has been done at a quark mass which makes m pi over m rho so large that the rho doesn't decay to 2 pi. Okay, so you're trying to do an extrapolation into a region where the rho has become unstable with data which you've only taken where it's stable, and you know that this is not going to be such a smooth extrapolation. Now, you know how it's a trickier thing, and people have done it in toy models of looking at cases where there are unstable particles on the lattice, and you know you get level crossings when they go unstable or avoided level crossings. And you think in principle you know how to do it, but it is much harder to do, and that's one of the reasons why even in this simplest of all stories, we aren't there yet, right? Because we've really got to push down to smaller quark masses and really look at the region where the rho became unstable.
But you can consider the case where there is no real decay of rho.
Right.
Let's say it's pi is k, right? Would it be
a k? Excuse me, where the pi...
I can take the mass of pi is larger than a half a mass
right.
of rho.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just show you an example of that.
And then there is no,
then there's no problem, okay? Then we believe the calculations, but it's harder to compare that to experiment, but yeah, right. And I showed you that there one has things under good control. Okay. Now, okay. What they were going to 120. Okay. Let me. The calculation of the light hadron masses is sort of a warm-up problem for lattice gauge theories, because after all, we all know what they are. But there are a whole set of particles which experimentalists are out busy looking for, which we'd like to calculate, which aren't there in the quark model. They can't, mesons that can't be made out of Q bar Q or baryons that can't be made out of three quarks. And some of these go by the name of exotic particles. And they can be made out of, for example, a meson out of a quark and a quark and some glue. And there are glue balls themselves, which are just all glue. And you'd very much like to be able to calculate those masses. Now, those are significantly harder. I mean, we haven't even finished this job, but those are harder for a couple of reasons. One is that they're much heavier, and as I just showed you, you run out of you lose control of the propagator. And the other is that you have to have sources where you have gluons as well as, say, quark-antiquark pairs, and those are much noisier. So these are harder to do. But I want to just show you a few pictures from a preliminary attempt to do that. And here's what this graph shows is, for example, the traditional pion propagator with using quark-antiquark states and one using quark-antiquark gluons. After all, the pion will couple to states with Q bar Q and gluons in it. And the same thing for the rho, and so on. The important point here is you can do it, you can see the signal, and the propagators are parallel, which means that the masses you will read off are the same. Now, here's a propagator for a 1 minus plus, which you can't make out of Q bar Q. It's an exotic meson. And these are created with a source, and then we're looking at three different sinks. This one is the same sink as the source. This is a different one. And this is a four-quark state, which these things can couple to. And again, you can see that you can sort of read those off, but not as good, not as well as we were doing these more well-known states. Here's a sort of a summary of the results. This thing, 1 over kappa, is proportional to the quark mass. And here's the pi, the rho, the A1. This 1 minus plus, you can calculate it two ways, and it gives you an idea of the error estimate. And this is a 0 plus minus, which is the first excited exotic state. So you're beginning to be able to calculate the masses of these particles. The problem is that we have not done all those nice extrapolations anywhere as nearly as well as we've done it for the light hadrons. But what we get for the 1 minus plus is something like 1.97 plus or minus what? 3.3 GeV. And the best, and another lattice group gets the same thing. This is for the lowest mass exotic meson. This is for a 1 minus plus. Okay. And the best experimental candidate is something like 1.37 plus or minus, what did they say? 0.16. So that's a pretty big discrepancy, but there's a lot to be questioned in the lattice calculation. And again, what this shows is one is beginning to get there, but one isn't where one would want to be to quite to help the experimentalists.
Question?
Yeah.
Do we have to worry about the lifetime of decay rate?
These numbers are in for the quenched approximation where they don't decay. Yeah, but we do. Well, yes, absolutely, we're going to have to worry about that. Right. Yeah. Glue ball is sort of in the same shape. There are candidates, and there are lattice calculations where maybe it's a little bit better shape. It depends on it. Yeah, if you talk to Don Weingarten, he will tell you it's in perfect shape, and he understands the whole thing and the mixing of the glue ball with the four quark states and such. And if you talk to some other people, well, it's not so shaky. But I think I would say it's in better shape than this. But I don't want to leave you with the question of spectrum where you think you can't do anything really well. So here is maybe the best spectrum calculation ever done, not done by our group, but done by Peter Lepage and Christy Davies, who was visiting here a year ago and company. And this is the particle data group's figure on the calculation of alpha strong at the mass of the Z. And here are all sorts of experimental determinations, and here is the lattice result, whose error bars are about as small as anybody's. This comes from looking at the epsilon spectrum. That's BB bar for the non-experts. And what these people have done is they have calculated on the lattice the bound states of BB bar and the excited states. And those you can count because they're heavy quarks and because you think you really understand what the effects of the light quarks are, unlike when you're calculating light hadrons, they calculate very well the both the masses and the mass splittings. And therefore, among other things, they calculate very well the lattice spacing on this lattice. They then go back and calculate on the same lattices, having determined all the quark masses and the bare gauge coupling and everything to match, have this experiment match, have their calculations of these masses match experiment. Things like small Wilson loops, which are completely controlled by the high momentum behavior, therefore can be calculated in perturbation theory. So they can match the perturbation theory then with the lattice calculation. And what those two things, when taken together, do is give them the running coupling constant at a known value of at a known scale. And then they can scale it up to the mass of the Z. And it's very, very nice. It is special because of the fact that they're working in a sector where it's really the heavy quarks that matter. You can calculate the masses of the C and B quarks very accurately this way, too. But that's the sort of result that one is aiming for, not just for that one thing, but for everything in lattice gauge theory.
Well, when you think about different combinations of alpha at the different scales, I guess you can really say the beta functions you measure can be plotted.
You can do that.
Different calculations and really see the running.
Yes. Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people do that. Sorry, I should have brought you a picture of that. But yeah, people do that, and it fits. I think the words are amazingly well in terms of the people who have done that. So yeah, that's something which is sort of easier to do. Okay. Yes.
So the calculations you were discussing, where the dynamical force was kept, how many different flavors did it
have? Good. The ones that I showed you were done with two flavors, just the up and down quarks. Okay, and that's another potential problem with the MN to MRO, although having the C quark sticking in the wrong direction, you should have the strange quark in there. And there have not been very many lattice calculations done with the strange quarks included, and that's a difficulty which really simply has to do only with computer time, because you have to not only do this, but you really have to tune your parameters so that the ratio of the strange to the up and down quarks is correct, and you have to keep tuning as you go along. It is what you should do when you have sufficient amount of computing time, but it's been rare that one has done that. Okay. Yes? Excuse me, Dee? In this one?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I think the biggest source of systematic error here is in estimating the effects of the light quarks. Okay. That has been done. There's an argument that goes with that, and there are some errors that are associated with that, but. The estimate is that the mass splittings of these epsilon states are linear in the light quark masses, and one of the reasons you can do the calculation is it's just the sum of the up down strange that comes in. That's not an exact statement, and there's an attempt to estimate the error associated with that, but the actual statistical errors are extremely small. A possible warning about that, the one possible caveat about that is when they first did that calculation, they did it in the quenched approximation and didn't quite get as good results. Then they took these lattices that I showed you that we had generated to do the light hadron spectrum, and they redid everything on that, and then it worked much better. But since those things are not at, those lattices are not at zero lattice spacing, and the dynamical quark masses are reasonably large, you could worry. So they had to make some estimates about those effects, and you know, you can worry a little bit whether their error estimates are are good or not. I'm running out of time, and I do want to get to the weak interaction, so I think I'm going to skip over a lot of the stuff on high-temperature QCD, but just do want to show you one thing that you can calculate real well, which is the temperature of the transition. And some things are really pretty stable. This is the ratio of TC to M rho, calculated with two different types of actions, so two different ways of putting quarks on the lattice. NT is the number of time slices, and since TC is 1 over the lattice spacing times NT, as NT gets larger, the lattice spacing gets smaller, and this is plotted against m pi over m rho squared, and this is the physical value of m pi over m rho squared, and what's truly amazing is, except for this one case of the Wilson quarks with very coarse lattices, it does amazingly well. And what it just says is that the it looks like the effects on TC and MRO, finite lattice spacing, finite quark mass, and such, are well really track each other pretty well. What you'd really like to calculate for the nuclear physicist is the equation of state, and I'll just show you this has only been done on very coarse lattices because it's very computationally intensive, and this is the energy density over T to the fourth, and this is the pressure, three times the pressure over T to the fourth. And on this lattice, it hasn't saturated the Stefan-Boltzmann law yet, but you can at least see it rising very sharply, the energy density through the transition. And there's a nice story to be told there, and there's a lot of work to be done because if you could just push that calculation to smaller lattice spacing so you had greater confidence in it, it's a really important thing for lattice gauge theory to do. However, let me go on and talk a little bit about weak interactions. just for the condensed matter people, I showed you the parameters in QCD, the gauge coupling and the quark masses. If we go on to the standard model, there are another set of parameters called the CKM matrix, which come about because the mass eigenstates of the quarks are not the same as the states that couple to the weak currents, and those that matrix which expresses that coupling or the rotation between those two types of eigenstates represent fundamental parameters of of the standard model. Some of those have been measured very well, and some of them have not. And one of, you know, where the B factory at SLAC, which is just opening, has as one of its major objectives to look at time reversal violations, and particularly the mixing between B mesons and their antiparticles. B is made up of a D and an anti-B quark, or B sub S and its antiparticle. And this is a strange and an anti-B quark. And if you calculate the wavelength for the for that mixing, it's proportional to, in the case of the B, to one of these elements of the CKM matrix, CTD squared, and the decay constant of the B and something called the B parameter. And down here, it's VTS squared B sub S. Now, the experimentalists are going to measure the whole product. You'd want these, and you really need the lattice calculations to get these quantities so you can extract. There's another set, VBU and VBS, which are, in particular, VBU is, I think, known only to a factor of two, which can be calculated where, again, you need the lattice calculations to relate them to the to relate the experiment to the to the fundamental standard model parameters. So there is a major effort going on in lattice gauge theory to calculate these things. And I just maybe talk about the top two. For the semi-experts, what you have to do, the coupling constant is the matrix element of the axial vector current between the vacuum and a state containing a B particle. to calculate that on the lattice, what you need to do is have an operator which creates a B particle. It has the right quantum numbers and the current. And if I put in a complete set of states here, it goes something like this. And if I let T be large, in other words, the distance on the lattice between the current and this operator, which has the right quantum numbers to create the B, since the B is the lightest particle in this channel, we'll get out this matrix element in F sub B, the thing we wanted to calculate. Now, I still got to calculate that matrix element, so I use that as both a source and a sink, and again, at large distances, it gives me a measurement of the matrix element. So there's a sort of a long story here. These are sort of a next generation up from calculating the masses, and you've got to, again, go through all of the pain that I was talking about in order to, with the finite size and lattice spacing extrapolations and all that, to then extract the physics from it. Now, you know that these decay constants have, you know what their dependencies on the mass, in this case of the B particle, and here's our calculation of it, and this point is a completely different calculation. This is just in the static approximation, but the idea is we can adjust the massing and go for F sub B or F sub B or whatever has right quantum numbers. No, this is not. This is just right. Other people have looked at non-relativistic QCD. They get answers which are in agreement with our answers. Okay, so one is done at both ways. One can start by taking the B quarks to be non-relativistic from the start. We didn't do that. We left them as being relativistic. We have to do an extrapolation. Now, in the heavy quarks, we also have to do an extrapolation in the light quark masses. Then, in the end, we have to do an extrapolation in the lattice spacing. And here's what it looks like. At F sub D looks very much the same. The diamonds are in the quenched approximation, and these crosses, which are at much larger lattice spacing, are within full QCD, and there isn't, right, we haven't brought them, enough of them down to really extrapolate the full QCD calculations, but we did try to use these differences to, oh, this is the extrapolated value just using the quenched results. So that's the number we quote, okay? We try to estimate what the errors are by seeing how, at the same lattice spacing, the full QCD differs from the quenched approximation. That, of course, is not what you want to do. You want to really do it. Okay.
It looks like they could come out pretty different.
It does actually look like they could come out pretty different. Yes, indeed, it does. If you were really bold, you tried to do something, it would come out around. Not quite two, but it was a significant amount different, if you believe that. That's right. Yes. yes. Yeah, but I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't want to quote anything. Okay. Oh, this error is simply the error within the quenched approximation. Okay. We did a fit to these points, and here's a linear fit, and here's the uncertainty associated with it. Here's a table of results. Okay. Now, the first error is up there is statistical. The second one is our estimate of the systematic errors within the quenched approximation, because we've done all these extrapolations, so we think somewhat under control. And the last one is our estimate of the error due to quenching. Now, that is, as Gordy pointed out, is questionable, okay, and I, that those errors make me very nervous.
Do you add those errors linearly?
Yeah, I tend to add those linearly. These are from a paper we published in PhysRev Letters. And since we published that paper, we've done more in full QCD. And I think if we were going to do these error, redo the error analysis, these errors would be larger, not smaller. You do better with ratios because a lot of things cancel. Now, you can ask here and in the other things. Well, this has to do, of course, this thing has to do with the wave function at the origin. And it's just there that getting like quarks, well, with that can make a real difference. But I'm not really confident. I can't give you a really good physical answer, David, which is unfortunate, to be sure. Yeah, I wanted to avoid talking about that because, well, I'm innocent. I've never done that. However, there are two calculations now which have at least have preprints, which are wildly different. In fact, one even has the opposite sign from experiment. And I talked to Fred Gilman about this a couple of weeks ago, who is, I think, the real expert, and he was telling me it's impossible.
There is no any reliable calculation of cables to supply. So
not yet. In fact, they won't admit that they're wrong. So that's something that's completely up in the air, okay, in my opinion. Just in my opinion. Okay. So what, you know, where are you on these things? There are two ways that you can really improve this. And one way is simply to have more computer power. Since the early 80s when people started doing that, I mean, the standard calculations ran at a speed of about half a megaflop. By comparison, my lattice gauge theory code on my PC runs at about 40 or 50 megaflops. And these real calculations run at up to a few hundred gigaflops on current parallel machines. So there have been six orders of magnitude improvement in computing power in about 18 years, which a lot of that is, part of that is just Moore's law, and part of that is the introduction of parallel computing. And there's about to be another revolution because you can so easily put together commodity chips with commodity interconnects, and Linux provides you with a free operating system. And so for very cheap, you can build very powerful computers. And that's going to happen. Okay? And you say, well, that calculation of alpha strong was probably a few gigaflop years of computing power. The current state of the art is maybe more like projects that take 50 gigaflop years. And I think that you can say that to really do this, and maybe this is, well, this was probably 20 gigaflop years in the calculation. I think you can say that with a few teraflop years, you can really do the full QCD calculation with our current algorithms and have error bars that you can really believe. Okay. Now, there are other things you can do too. And one of the ones that people are working on the most is to have to improve the methods in which you discretize the theory. Okay, what basically has been done up to a few years ago was, okay, we have that action, which I wrote down. There are derivatives hidden in there, and people just took the simplest finite difference things. Okay, well, and they led to discretization errors, which were proportional to A in most cases, to the lattice basic. But you know that you can write down fancier approximations to the derivative in terms of finite differences, which will give you things which put a squared or a cubed or what have you. And you also, as it turns out, that when you have these derivatives or as a difference between two lattice points, you typically do the parallel transport just on the link combining them. But of course, really, you should go via neighboring links and do all sorts of other funny things. And what those tend to do is smooth out the calculations and also eliminate, help you eliminate some of these lattice artifacts. So I'll just show you one picture, which our group is doing, but other groups are doing things with different different improved actions. This one gets rid of all the order a squared artifacts, at least at tree level. And what this is a calculation of the row mass in some units versus the lattice spacing in some squared in some units. And these are the standard action, which I actually showed you calculations of before, although at a different scale. And these are a couple of semi-improved actions. And this one is this good through order, completely good through order, a squared one. What you hope is going to come out, and these error bars are simply because this is very preliminary work and we haven't run very long. But what this is, what one hopes one is going to be able to do is to work at significantly larger lattice spacings and therefore significantly smaller lattices. Remember, I told you the work goes like 1 over lattice spacing to the 6th. So if you can work at twice the lattice spacing and do the extrapolations as reliably, then you've gained more than an order of magnitude in your computing power. So that is simply to say that there are two important tracks by which these calculations are being improved. But I think, as you've seen, we're with a bit of improvement, we're on the verge of being able to calculate some pretty important quantities. But we ain't there yet. Well, let me say, if he had a factor, I forget, of 1,000 or something, but the spectrum, these calculations that I've showed you for FB or for the spectrums, it didn't take 1,000 years, so he should be finished the whole thing by now. Now. His improvements are in precisely doing things like this in somewhat different ways. Okay, it's the same thing. Tadpoles are in here too. But let me not be careful. Peter, it was what really been one of the leaders in pushing towards improving the actions, making the perturbation theory smoother, so that you can do these things in none of them. Look, there. You know, the calculations that I showed you, both for S sub B or for the spectrum or such, none of the calculations have been done with that much attention and that many extrapolations. They have all been done on things like this, where you look at some specific quantities and you try to see how much better you're doing, which isn't to say that, well, there may be an exaggeration. There have been some, but not too much. We are, as I speak, really trying to do some very significant calculations with improved actions, as are other people around the world. But there are no finished ones that are really in that point. Oh, 40-10 or so.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah.
Periodically, there are people, as you said, claim to have improvements, but this doesn't happen.
Right? Yeah. Right. No, it hasn't.
No.
What was promised there was that you could really have quarks on the lattice with exact chiral symmetry at finite lattice spacing and without extra degrees of freedom, without extra modes. Okay. The price you pay for that is an extra dimension in the calculation. Okay. So the reason it's been slow to develop is that it's a very significant increase in the amount of computer work that is being done. So if you ask, for example, Norman Crist with his special purpose machine, it's almost all of that time is now being devoted to these domain wall fermions. Okay, and so their calculation of epsilon prime over epsilon is for example, with those. And right. So that's a different subject, which I didn't talk at all about because I thought that was going to have someone else come and tell us about this. There is this whole development with chiral gauge theories on the lattice where you really now seem to be able to do that. And that's a real that's a major theoretical advance because it says you can really define and have a non-perturbative theory, a chiral gauge theory. So that's really a great advance. That's whether it gets into this engineering problem I've been talking about in the near future is not. Not so clear, but it's very important. Yes. Yeah. Well, they're starting using different actions, and they're going about doing the calculation in rather different ways. Of course I can't tell you that that's impossible. I personally think it's unlikely, but that's just my personal opinion, right? I think there's something wrong with one of the calculations, and it's the one that gives the wrong sign. But but I think we have to wait and see. People have done a lot of these calculations with, you know, starting in very different ways, starting with different actions, and typically ending up within the error say quo with the same answers, and that gives you a lot of confidence. I showed you our results for F sub E, and there are these results from the UK QCD collaboration, which are in complete agreement with ours, which are done with lattices generated with a different action, and the calculations on those lattices in their case are done with non-relativistic quarks, and ours are done with fully relativistic ones. Really different in the whole approach, and bang, when the answer is done, they agree with in errors. That gives me a lot of confidence that in the case of F sub E and F sub E sub S, we're doing it right. even though I don't have full confidence in the error bars that. I don't understand why things should fall apart. They should. Right. I guess I shouldn't say anything more about the epsilon prime thing. Other questions?
Is there some analysis I've seen on the space bar map from Lattice using Lattice?
The up and down quark masses tend to be smaller than the results from the QCD sum rules, right? But I think everyone agrees that the strange quark. Well, I guess that's consistent, right? The strange quark mass comes out to be about 20 times larger than the up and down quark masses. So if you have up and downs be small, then you're going to have the strange quark ones be small, too. Yeah. So that's good. It looks pretty good. I think it's pretty reliable. It's reliable, but there's some significant extrapolations going on. It's actually the real problem. You know, it's based on extrapolations of the type that I showed you, but. The real problem there is going from the lattice to the MS bar renormalization. And that's done, up to now, that's done perturbatively when it should really be done non-perturbatively. And that's, if there's a problem, that's where the problem is. It's something that's quite doable, but it's not been done. It's only been done perturbatively. So, is that likely to be a factor of two though wrong? I tend to doubt it, but it could be. I mean, it's not. I wouldn't bet my house on. I don't think the arguments with Alpha S have to, the big thing you have to buy there is that the dependence on the quark mass is on the average of the light quark masses that are participating. That's up, down, and strange. So you ought to be able to do the simulation with three quarks of mass MS over three, okay? Instead of two really light ones and one much heavier one. And then you have much more control. Now, in fact, actually, there's a... revealing all the things that got hidden under the rug. What actually happened was he did it with zero and two and extrapolated to three. Okay, so there's... But the whole changes, right? The change in from zero to two is a very small effect. The light quarks, when you're calculating the epsilon splittings, just have very little effect. They're at the few percent level. So even if their estimates are not very good, they aren't having a big effect on the final answer. Okay, that's the real reason I think one believes those answers.
I'd like to The mixing sentence between the vacuum state of two spark operators and the proton. And this turns into the proton decay light and vacuum into the supersymmetric field.
Mm-hmm.
And since the experiment is now underway, and it's very crucial to know, I think, as accurately as possible, I mean, the estimates that I have seen of, so will I go back to like 15 years ago.
Mm.
And somehow the vacuum community hasn't quite addressed.
Okay. Well, that's something we we ought to be able to do. Yeah, it's probably not a hard it's not a hard calculation. Yeah, I see. Yeah, I mean, when you know, it's very closely related to the FB calculation in what the techniques you need to do it. And sure. Good.
Well, that's
fantastic.